This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pafiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's leader calls for a huge voter turnout in Friday's presidential election, saying such participation contributes to removing economic pressure and sanctions on the country. U.S. Democratic and Republican lawmakers are set to introduce a bill seeking to boost Washington's support for Taiwan amid rising tensions with China. And also, China launches a spacecraft with three astronauts as part of a mission for the construction of the country's first full-fledged space station. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has highlighted the significance of elections in the country prior to Friday's presidential vote. Ayatollah Khamenei called for a huge voter turnout in the presidential election and urged people from all walks of life to participate irrespective of their political affiliations. He said the huge presence of people at the ballot boxes will contribute to removing economic pressure and sanctions on the country. The leader also warned of enemy attempts to undermine people's participation in the election. Ayatollah Khamenei added that Iran's enemies have also made futile attempts to drive a wedge between people and the Islamic establishment. He said American and British media and their mercenaries have also tried to question the veracity of Iran's elections. The leader noted that people, however, have foiled such plans by their huge participation in various elections held in the country. Political commentator Alexander Azadegan says the United States is in no position to criticize Iran's elections.
I fundamentally disagree with the argument that, you know, if less people vote, that is a vote of no confidence for the Iranian system. Here in the United States, we are chronically more people are voting less. Only in 2020, we had a record of 161 million people who voted in that election. And that's because, you know, we had a lunatic, a malignant narcissist, who was looked upon as dangerous by the establishment within the Republican Party as well as the Democrats, of course. So, you know, we have no moral credibility to sit around and say the Iranian elections are illegitimate because millions and millions and millions of people, don't participate. We got an outrageous and serious voter suppression laws that may be passing in Republican-controlled legislatures around the country because Republicans are 100% inherently racist, at least the Trumpist Republicans. So democracy is being killed at the ballot box here in the U.S., and we really don't have any moral credibility to pick at anybody over their election.
A Palestinian teenager has succumbed to injuries he sustained in clashes with Israeli forces during an anti-settlement protest in the northern occupied West Bank on Wednesday. 16-year-old Ahmad Bani Shamsa was shot in the head by Israeli forces in the village of Beita, south of Nablus. He was among the demonstrators who had gathered there to voice anger at the construction of new settler units near the village. Tensions have been running high in the occupied territories for the past few months over Israel's illegal settlement activities and the regime's planned eviction of Palestinian families from their homes in some neighborhoods. Last month's deadly aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip also added to Palestinians' fury. The European Union says its relationship with Russia has never been worse and is likely to deteriorate further. A new policy document on the matter from the European Commission will be considered by EU leaders next week, Jerome Hughes reports.
Push back, constrain, and engage. These are the core elements contained in a European Commission policy proposal which has just been presented relating to Russia. The 27-country bloc's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, says the EU must be realistic.
And prepare for a further downturn of our relations with Russia, which are right now at the lowest level. And this further downturn is the most likely outlook for the time being.
The new policy proposal suggests the EU must push back against Russia's human rights violations and international law breaches. This mostly relates to Ukraine and Georgia. The EU must constrain attempts by Moscow to undermine EU interests. Here the document talks about cyber attacks. But the bloc should engage with Russia on COVID-19, climate change, travel visas, and efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal. Big claims require big evidence, and the EU has never come forward with a shred of evidence, the Kremlin insists. There are many experts who believe the EU is going down the wrong path.
The West has an interest, an institutional self-interest, in aggravating the crisis with Russia, a crisis which need never have started in the first place, but which was aggravated by the way the West supported the most radical elements in Ukraine.
Borrell was asked about the EU's dependency on Russia's energy. He responded, there is no mention of this subject at all in the policy document. The Commission proposal contains a provision for additional sanctions on Russia, but EU leaders are divided over the effectiveness of such measures. They will make their final decisions on the matter during a summit here at the European Council next week. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The U.S. House of Representatives will introduce bipartisan legislation in support of Taiwan next week. The bill called the Taiwan Peace and Stability Act is part of the U.S.'s congressional efforts in taking a hard line in dealing with China. The Democratic and Republican leaders of the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Asia say the bill stresses the importance of stability, Taiwan's economy and development, and its participation in international organizations. However, they noted that the legislation does not question Washington's commitment to one China policy under which Beijing has sovereignty over Taiwan. China has repeatedly warned the U.S. against its interference in Taiwan. The self-ruled island continues to remain a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington. China has successfully sent a manned mission to space for the construction of its self-developed space station. The spaceship called Shenzhou 12, carrying three astronauts, lifted off from a satellite launch center in northwest China. The astronauts will stay and work on the space station's core module, dubbed Tianhe, for 3 months. It's the first of 11 missions needed to complete China's first full-fledged space station. China started its construction in April with the launch of Tianhe, which is the first and largest of three required modules. Since 2003, China has launched six crewed missions and sent 11 astronauts into space. China is also the second country to put a rover on Mars after the United States. The coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll on India as the country struggles to contain the disease. India reported more than 67,000 new infections over the past 24 hours, bringing the total cases to 29.7 million. Overall deaths hover around 382,000. The new daily infections in India dropped in recent days after a surge in April and May. Daily infections reached their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the surge. The country now has the second largest caseload and the third highest death toll in the world. Britain has reported more than 9,000 coronavirus cases in the latest 24-hour period. That's the highest daily increase since February. The total number of coronavirus cases in the country now stands at 4,580,000 The UK also recorded another 9 deaths. The total number of coronavirus-related fatalities in Britain now stands at 128,000. Meanwhile, in Russia, Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin has warned, quote, the coronavirus situation continues to unfold dramatically, ordering mandatory jabs in the city. Despite this, the EU has agreed to lift coronavirus restrictions for U.S. travelers as Western countries are moving toward a return to pre-COVID life. The decision comes ahead of the busy summer holiday season, critical to the economies of many member nations. Turkey says it has administered about 36 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine since it launched a mass vaccination campaign in mid-January. Turkish officials hope to fully lift pandemic lockdown by July. Rashan Sağlam reports from Istanbul.
Turkish health minister said that the harsh phase of the COVID-19 pandemic in Turkey is nearing to an end, adding the daily infection cases have decreased sharply in the past weeks.
Today, I think the acute period of the pandemic is nearing its end, and we are starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Turkey administered 1.2 million doses of coronavirus vaccine in a single day on Tuesday, according to the Turkish Health Ministry. The number marks a record in Turkey's vaccination campaign. More than 21.7 million people have received their first doses, while over 13.9 million have been fully vaccinated.
When Turkey first launched its mass vaccination campaign, it grappled with some logistic problems, but today I think the country is on the right track to tackle the pandemic by the next month.
Turkey eased pandemic restrictions in June, as now restaurants are allowed to welcome customers in certain capacity, and total lockdown is only imposed on Sundays. Turkey's overall case tally is now over 5.34 million, while the nationwide death toll has reached nearly 50,000. To contain the virus, Turkey currently has a nightly curfew from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. from Monday to Saturday, and a full lockdown on Sundays. With its fast vaccination campaign, Turkey is going to tackle the pandemic by the end of this month, with most of the residents and citizens vaccinated, and life can go back to normal again. Rashan Sağlam, Istanbul.
Brazilian health officials have recorded almost 3,000 daily COVID-19 fatalities, pushing the virus-stricken country's death toll closer to 500,000. Total confirmed cases in Brazil also surpassed 17.6 million after the health ministry registered more than 95,000 infections in one day. Brazil has witnessed the world's third worst outbreak and remains the second deadliest following the U.S. Meanwhile, the U.S. marked the alarming milestone of 600,000 deaths on Tuesday as vaccination slows in the country. U.S. officials have also so far recorded nearly 33.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19. Well, an Afghan delegation comprising politicians, MPs, and retired diplomats is in Islamabad under what is known as track to diplomacy. This after negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban failed to show any sign of progress amid allegations that Islamabad is supporting the militant group Javed Ron Asmor from Islamabad.
The U.S. troops are fast withdrawing from Afghanistan under a peace deal American had with the Taliban 2 years ago. On the other hand, the Taliban, the militant group who already control nearly 75% territory, is now sieging and capturing districts and regions around the capital city. The Afghan government blames neighboring Pakistan for supporting Taliban's ongoing rapid territorial gains, an allegation Pakistan denies. With new law in the bilateral ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, influential former diplomats, think tanks, and politicians from the both sides held meeting in Islamabad. The objective behind this gathering, better known as Track 2 diplomacy, is to bring down the tension between two countries and help Kabul to find out a peaceful solution. Negotiations between the Taliban and Ashraf Ghani government have resumed in Doha with no progress in sight. The Taliban wants setting up their brand of an Islamic government, while Ashraf Ghani is not willing to accept an interim setup to replace him. The U.S. fears the Taliban could possibly overrun the capital Kabul if President Ashraf Ghani does not strike a peace deal with them.
And the withdrawal obviously will take place, with or without the settlement. God forbid we are sucked back into the 90s and there is anarchy, civil war. Is that a concern? Yes, it is.
The U.S. has made it clear that Pentagon would not carry out airstrikes from its aircraft carriers outside Afghanistan to prevent Taliban's possible takeover of capital Kabul.
The Americans are tired of this war. They are fatigued, and they want to leave as soon as possible. And they don't want to invest more money, more energy, and they don't want to fight in Afghanistan any longer. Taliban are very confident they will be able to establish, their upper hand in any future dispensation.
In a recent interview with a German newspaper, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he knows his death is just one bullet away. Analysts believe that his remarks shows on how he perceives the threat of Taliban's violent takeover of capital Kabul after the U.S. lost war and left his government onto the mercy of warring Taliban. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
A potential deadly stunt by a 69-year-old pro-Palestine activist in London has come to an end. Nicholas George spent 2 days and an entire night atop a huge crane overlooking the U.S. Embassy to raise awareness of Israel's crimes against the Palestinians, Robert Carter reports from London.
After two perilous days and a difficult night, 69-year-old activist Nicholas Georges has returned to ground level after mounting a huge crane overlooking the U.S. Embassy in London. Armed with little more than a Palestinian flag, Georges risked his life in the daredevil stunt to raise awareness of Israeli crimes against the Palestinians. Apart from the obvious risk of falling to his death, the two-day ordeal has been very challenging in other ways too, as explained by fellow activists supporting him from the ground.
Apart from the climb itself, which was huge, he has suffered from the cold at night because he couldn't fit a sleeping bag onto his backpack. So he spent last night very cold, and he sent a few messages saying, "I'm really, really cold." Luckily, because he's so high up, the crane actually caught the first morning sun, so he was the first person to actually warm up. But now he's suffering from the heat, because obviously there's no shade.
As supporters cheered Mr. George's successful landing, he was unable to speak directly to us, as any media talks after this action could affect his possible court battle to come.
So there you have it. Nick is back down safe and sound. But the battle will not end here. After a visit to hospital, Nick will likely be brought in for questioning by the police and potentially even charged for some of the conduct over the past couple of days. Then could come a lengthy court battle, which Nick will have to fight against as well. But the lessons that can be taken from this is that the activists behind these brave actions know the consequences, but they still do it anyway, meaning that until there is a solution for the oppressed Palestinian people, this type of action will continue to occur, not just in the UK, but worldwide, possibly as well. Robert Carter, London.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, Just as thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon thee. By Muhammad, the chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but thy generosity, and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Right now, the Israeli regime's courts are in the process of ethnically cleansing the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. As we get to know the new prime minister and cabinet of the fake regime of Israel, we continue to watch the Zionist regime forcibly remove Palestinians from East Al-Quds. We worry about a next massacre in Gaza, and we continue to hear the absurd label of Israel as a democratic regime. Dear listeners, this was part of an article published in the Common Dreams website under the heading New Israeli Regime PM, Same Israeli Regime Apartheid. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. After 12 years, the fake regime of Israel finally inaugurated a new prime minister. Naftali Bennett is at best a continuation of Netanyahu's policies, and at worst, an ideologue whose positions are to the right of Netanyahu's. In 2013, as West Asia peace talks were set to resume after a five-year freeze, Bennett reportedly proclaimed to the Israeli regime National Security Advisor Yaakov Admirer, "I've killed lots of Arabs in my life, and there is no problem with that," unquote. In 2014, Bennett, who had previously been the director of Yesha Settlements Council, called for more settlement construction. He said, "This is the time to act," adding, "We must continue building in all corners of Israel with determination and without being confused. We are building and we will not stop," unquote. In 2016, As the Zionist regime's minister of education, Bennett called on Israeli Jews to give their lives to annex the West Bank. Bennett's remarks invoked Kahanism, a Jewish supremacist ideology based on the views of Rabbi Meir Kahan that called for violence and terrorism to be used to secure the faith regime of Israel as an ethno-nationalist regime. In 1994, Israeli settler and Kahan follower Baruch Goldstein massacred Palestinians in the West Bank Ibrahimi Mosque. In 1988, the Ka'a party was banned from running for the Israeli Knesset. In 2004, the U.S. State Department labeled Ka'a a terrorist organization. Sunday, June 13, 2021, right before he was inaugurated to replace Netanyahu as the prime minister of the fake regime of Israel, Bennett doubled down on his anti-Palestinian views, proclaiming that his cabinet would strengthen settlements across the whole of Israel, unquote. Netanyahu's tenure was marked by corruption charges and shrewd maneuvers to remain in power, and what had become an endless cycle of Israeli regime elections during which the regime was paralyzed and unable to pass a budget for the past 3 years. Though the Palestinian Authority and Hamas are the official governments of the West Bank and Gaza, respectively, the fake regime of Israel is the absolute power in charge. The Zionist regime controls the borders, the currency, and the central bank. It collects taxes on behalf of the Palestinian Authority, maintains the right to carry out military operations on Palestinian land, and controls the amount of freedom, or lack thereof, that Palestinians are granted. The fake regime of Israel approves only about half of the permits that residents of Gaza apply for to travel outside of Gaza for vital medical treatment. In 2017, 54 people died while awaiting a permit to travel for medical treatment, leading to Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Medical Aid for Palestinians, MAP, Physicians for Human Rights Israel, PHRI, and Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights to release a joint statement calling for the blockade of Gaza to be lifted. Reasons for denying people in Gaza necessary medical treatment are often absurd, such as denying travel because a relative at one time moved from Gaza to the West Bank without Israeli regime permission. Right now, the Israeli regime's courts are in the process of ethnically cleansing the East Davos neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. As we get to know the Israeli regime's new prime minister and cabinet, we continue to watch the Zionist regime forcibly remove Palestinians from East Davos. We worry about a next massacre in Gaza, and we continue to hear the absurd label of Israel as a democratic regime.
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is John and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about India's nascent alliance called Quad with Japan and Australia, as well as the United States, and its impact on geopolitics of the Indo-Pacific region. And we shall also take a look at the recent rise of Maoist attacks in India and the prospects of peace for the decades-old insurgency.
Some call it the Asian NATO, but many believe this is a misnomer. The Quad is a combination of a couple of trilateral ties with India or US at the center that is now shaped into a four-way partnership. The quadrilateral security dialogues bringing together United States, Japan, Australia, and India, but such an alliance may provoke a spiraling set of reactions from other Asian players, such as China and Russia.
Consequently, this week, the OECD...
Leaders of the four-member Quad grouping, or the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, held their first summit mid-March 2021, but the strategic partnership, presumably against China, was in the making since the beginning of the century. The Quad was first established by then-President George W. Bush following the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami and, after a long hiatus, was reconvened by Donald Trump in 2017. Its advertised aim was fostering a free, open, and inclusive Indo-Pacific region, but the implicit goal was to address concerns about Beijing's growing economic influence, military prowess, and technological heft. Although this year's virtual meeting focused on non-military initiatives and China was never mentioned in any statements or proceedings, the Quad has the potential to further divide the already complex geopolitical arrangement of Asia. Its extension, or the Quad Plus, including France, Canada, and perhaps the United Kingdom or New Zealand, may prompt a counter-axis with Russia or Pakistan in tandem with China.
India and three other Quad countries have recently kicked off a major naval exercise, along with France, in the Bay of Bengal. Such drills may be seen as a show of military might by these countries who don't mention it, but are apparently concerned about China's growing military. But Quad wants to be more than that. The members of the Quad and some of their friends believe the baby alliance has also the bandwidth to challenge non-security frontiers of Beijing's global influence.
The March 12th summit wrapped up with no direct reference to China, but the joint statement by Quad's four leaders was telling of a different story. The Quad leaders established working groups about COVID-19 vaccine development as well as cooperation in emerging technologies plus climate change. On the first glance, they seem irrelevant to China, but they are aimed at addressing the broader aspects of Beijing's central position in the global system. China is a pivotal player in international supply chains. This had never been so noticeable for the Quad members before the pandemic necessitated universal vaccine production and distribution. The Quad seeks to restructure supply chains to wean them away from Beijing. Another Quad initiative is to undercut China's influence in telecom and biotech. And climate activism is only there for the global appeal. All of these members have other bilateral or multilateral alliances or pacts specifically for the promulgated goals of Quad. They did not deliver, so what makes them expect a different result from a new name or clothing?
Now, to learn more about Quad and its purpose and aims, we have with us Mr. Victor Gao. He's the chair and professor of Suzhou University and the vice president of CCG. Mr. Gao, welcome to the program. So, what are the consequences of the formation of Quad, or as some call it, Asian NATO? Can we even call it an Asian NATO?
First of all, I think the fundamental premise for the formation of Quad, that is an informal alliance involving the United States, Japan, India, and Australia, is very much misplaced. Why? Because I think in the world of today, people want to have peace and development rather than having a resurgence of another Cold War or a conflict leading to a total war. And from the Chinese perspective, any attempt by one country or several countries to form a so-called alliance to contain China will be a failure, because it's impossible to contain a big and great country like China with 1.4 billion people bent upon peace and development. And China is now contributing anywhere roughly around one-third of any additional GDP growth for any given year in recent years. Therefore, to contain China and try to stop China's peaceful economic development is suicidal for the United States and other countries. Therefore, I think Quad, if it is designed to contain China, will be a miserable failure. And you can call Quad by any other name, for example, Asian NATO, for example, it will not be a success. It will not deliver the results that its member countries want to see it deliver.
All right, so you think it's a failure and it would be suicidal. Now, can India use Quad for its own gains?
I think you need to ask Indian government or some experts in India for this question. From our perspective, I think India is a developing country, it's a non-aligned country. It will serve India's interest better if it continues its non-aligned position, because that's really the core and the strength of Indian diplomacy for the past several decades. Secondly, India can really do a big favor for its own people and its own government if it maintains a focus on peace and stability and maintain good neighborly relations with its neighbors, including with China. China does not want to have a conflict or a war or confrontation with India. Both China and India are great countries with ancient histories, and we share a very long land boundary with each other. And both China and India need better investments and need to do more to improve the living standards of the Chinese people on the one hand and the Indian people on the other hand. We do not want to have a war. A war is not good for China. The war is not good for India. So let's talk peace rather than talk about war.
Now, how would China see or react to such a potential alliance?
Now, first of all, I don't think there is such an alliance to start with. What they are talking about is a very loose structure with no written document endorsed by their parliaments, elevating their relationship into an alliance. No, it's not an alliance, a very loose structure to start with. Secondly, I don't think these countries or these people really want to contain China. Why? Because it's a mission impossible. How can you contain a very big, important country, the biggest contributor to the global economic growth, the largest population in the world, and one of the strongest military in the world? So I think these countries will realize, including their people and their government, they will realize the futility of such attempt to contain China and the destructiveness of the attempt to set up a so-called alliance involving these four countries. These four countries, aligned together, will not be able to defeat China or hold China to the ground. They are talking about complete indulgence in fantasies rather than talking about realities on the ground. The Chinese government and the Chinese people do not want to have a war or conflict with any of these four countries. We want to have peace with them. We want to talk about business and cooperation and economic and financial cooperation included, for example. So we have better things to talk about rather than war or conflict or confrontation.
All right, that's a very interesting point. Now, isn't the Quad just another way of America to have military presence in the region?
Well, the United States is very much the mastermind of Quad, whatever it means and whatever it will evolve into. And I think the United States is really very much losing its own sanity over the rapid economic development over the past decades. And the economic disparity between the United States on the one hand and China on the other hand is very fast narrowing. As of the end of last year, China is already about 70%, if not a little bit more, than the United States, compared with the United States in terms of the overall size of the GDP, if we use official exchange rate as the benchmark. And there are lots of economists who are talking about that by another 10 years, if not even less, the Chinese economy, if we use the official exchange rate as the benchmark, will surpass that of the United States. And I think in China, we are very much confident that given the unity of China, given the strong leadership of China, the execution ability, delivery capacities of the Chinese government, and the overall support of the Chinese people for the peace and development strategies adopted by the Chinese government, China will surpass the economic size of the United States in about 10 years, if not even less. But does that mean that China wants to replace the United States as the top dog in the world? No. I don't think the Chinese government or the Chinese people want to be the top dog of the world. We want to see a world in a multilateral format, and every country, big or small, will be treated as an equal sovereign. And that's very, very important. And I think we all need to rally behind the United Nations, and we should not do anything to bully other countries, to violate the legitimate interests of the other countries, and to put yourself on top of the United Nations.
All right, thank you so much, Mr. Gao, for being with us on our program. It was very nice having you. Before moving ahead, let's just take a quick look at what's been going on cyberspace and social media.
Ronald Van Keekum has talked about the NATO-style alliance against China. Tom Fowdy has made fun of US double standard policies. He highlighted that Washington is only a friend to India in its rivalry against China and nowhere else. Navendra Tripathi called Quad the first step in the formation of a bigger front against China. Rab Rakha believes China should counter a threat such as Quad, and he believes it starts with doing something about India. Memory has tweeted a quote by a Chinese professor downgrading the Quad.
listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
In India, more than 20 policemen were killed in a recent ambush by Maoist militants in the mineral-rich state of Chhattisgarh. This came about a month after another similar attack by Maoist Naxal militants who have been waging attacks since 1967. The recent rise of Maoist attacks in India has revived concerns about this decades-old insurgency that has appeared largely contained. What does this resurgence mean for India?
Maoist militants, often referred to as Naxalite or Naxals, trace their roots to communist politics. They use violence against the state in the name of championing the cause of India's poor and marginalized. Naxalite groups have been active in the country since the 1960s, but the modern insurgency did not begin until the early 2000s. Since 1967, the group has asserted control over vast swaths of land in central and eastern India, establishing a so-called Red Corridor. The reach of the outfit was once so widespread and their attacks so frequent that in 2006, India's Prime Minister declared them the country's single biggest internal security challenge. The Indian government has hunted many of the insurgent leaders, killing a large number or forcing them to surrender. This, along with years of infighting, has declined the insurgent attacks in frequency and potency. Nevertheless, the group continues to launch hit-and-run attacks, ambushing security forces in friendly terrain and inflicting casualties in deadly battles.
According to data by the South Asia Terrorism Portal, over 100 people have been killed this year, and it's only April now. More than 2,100 civilians in India have been killed in the Maoist insurgency since 2010. The government's inability to contain such a homegrown insurgency has a heavy and bloody cost for the civilians and security personnel alike in areas under their reach. And the prospects for peace look dim because these areas are among the poorest in the country. Bad living conditions feed such an insurgency.
Although the insurgency has largely weakened since the 2010s, the well-planned ambush of this march and incidents of this kind are far from a novelty in the Maoist hotbeds. The change of Maoist leadership in late 2018 was seen as the return to increasingly aggressive tactics, such as assassinations of prominent figures and multi-pronged hits. But the ongoing pandemic seems to have impacted the insurgents' supply lines, thus hindering further attacks. The Indian government needs a coherent, long-term remedial approach. The current situation is paradoxical. Authorities turn to military force saturation and rely on disproportionate kinetic responses in Maoist-prone tribal areas. This keeps these regions underdeveloped and inhabitants unhappy, which in turn boost Maoist recruitments.
Now, to have more insight about the Naxalites and the Maoist insurgency in India, we are joined by Colonel Danveer Singh, who is an associate editor of the Indian Defence Review. Mr. Singh, welcome to the program. So, what do Maoists in India really want? Are they a serious threat?
Okay, this is a very interesting question because generally people think that it is a movement of some sort of separatism. So let me make it very, very clear that Maoist movement is not a separatist movement. It is a movement for regime change. These people follow the ideology of Mao from China, and they are not happy with the democratic system prevailing in India. They say that it is a capitalist system that exists in India, inherited from the Britishers. It oppresses the weak and the poor, and the oppression is by the capitalist people, and the state is representative of these oppressors. So officers per se, and they want to establish communist rule exactly on the lines of the Chinese Communist Party. So this is what their whole agenda and idea about this insurgency or this violence is.
The cost of government's inability to control the Maoists are the lives of the people. How can India handle the Maoist insurgency?
See, this Maoist insurgency is to be handled on various fronts. I personally feel, very firstly, it is to be handled at social level, wherein the people, affected people, or the people who reside in jungles and remote areas, they have to be provided by some kind of social security. When we talk of social security, it involves medical, it involves food, it involves various other amenities that other people do enjoy. Then we have to carry out administrative reforms, because administrative reforms are key to building a trustworthy connect between the poor, downtrodden, and those who are ruling or the system. So to integrate system with the people, you have to carry out administrative reforms. And administrative reforms are absolutely necessary because they are very archaic. We have inherited these systems from the British. They are not Indian system. They are not sensitive to the local way of thinking and living. So that is another point. Then we graduate on to other aspects of military. That is, we have to counter the propaganda war of the Maoists with great intensity. And lastly, we have to carry out friendly operations, military operations that do not harm the locals, but they target the Maoists. So we have to function on various levels, like I mentioned, to repeat them again. We have social, administrative, information, and military. So these are the four prongs that we have to invoke to counter the Maoist strategy. Otherwise, Maoists will continue to have their grip on the very low and far-flung strata living in the jungles of central India.
Now, during the time of Premier Manmohan Singh, it was believed that Naxalites or Naxalism was the greatest threat to Indian internal security. Do you think it is still the case?
As I mentioned, what Manmohan Singh had said in 2010 was absolute reality, because that was a time when all the disturbed areas combined, that is to do with the northeastern region, Kashmir, and the Maoist Red Corridor, it almost made up to 70% of India's landmass. That was very huge. That was extremely huge. So when he said that, that was a very right thing that he said that. And now things have changed. While the India still be 70% in a sense that the ideology or the Maoist ideology still resonates in the corners, but when it comes to Maoist insurgency, it is not that 70%. In that 70%, I included Northeast as well. So today, when we are talking, Northeast is virtually or literally free of insurgency, literally free. And Maoist insurgency out of 6-7 states, it has reduced and is confined to a very limited area of a small state called Chhattisgarh. That is all. Kashmir insurgency has also come down drastically, which is also on the verge of complete collapse, because it is also breathing its last. So when we look at the complete scenario and that 70% that I quoted, I don't think so. It is more than 10 to 15% as you and me are talking.
All right, Mr. Singh, thank you so much for being with us on our show. It was really nice having you here. Now, before ending, let's just take a quick look at the social media and cyberspace and what they think about the Naxalites and what's going on in India. Thank you.
Siddharth Kaushal believes that the Indian government should do whatever it can to contain the Maoist insurgency.
ARI Videos has shared videos to commemorate all those killed in Maoist attacks. This account with the handle Global Cyber Police says, with proper resources, he can eradicate the Maoist insurgency.
And this concludes our episode on the Quad Summit and the Maoist insurgency in India. We shall meet next week.
In the limelight.
An American woman has sued the U.S. State Police after accusing a police officer of using a dangerous technique to get her to pull over that wound up causing her car to flip upside down while she was pregnant. Nicole Harper, 38, claims she was driving home when senior Rodney Dunn willfully and wantonly engaged in extreme and outrageous conduct, but ramming her car and inflicted severe bodily injuries on her, according to her lawsuit obtained by Law and Crime. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Unequivocally Deadly, U.S. Cop Flips Over Car of Pregnant Woman Who Didn't Pull Over Fast Enough. Stay tuned for more. U.S. police dash cam footage that has begun to go viral recently has sparked outrage as it showed a state trooper in Arkansas forcing the SUV of a pregnant woman driver who claimed she was trying to find a safer place to pull over to crash and roll over during an attempted highway traffic stop in July of last year. Nicole Harper, who was 2 months pregnant when Rodney Dunn attempted to pull her over, filed a lawsuit against the Arkansas State Police last month, accusing the agency of negligence and excessive force. The dashcam footage shows Harper reducing her speed and turning her emergency flashers on after Dunn began trying to pull her over for allegedly driving at 84 miles per hour in a 70 mile per hour zone. Harper said the shoulder on the stretch of highway she was driving on was too narrow to safely pull to the side. According to the Arkansas driver's manual, a driver who is being pulled over is supposed to activate your turn signal or emergency flashers to indicate to the officer that you are seeking a safe place to stop. But Don waited just 2 minutes and 7 seconds after turning on his siren before treating Harper as a fleeing suspect, pulling up to the side of her car and nudging the left side. The Precision Immobilization Technique, PIT, maneuver caused Harper's vehicle to swerve into a concrete median and flip over. What was done on Ms. Harper was unequivocally deadly, Harper's attorney Andrew Norwood told Newsweek. According to NBC News, Harper feared she had suffered a pregnancy loss after the crash, but her doctor later confirmed that her unborn child was safe and her daughter was born earlier this year. Don, who is still on the force and has worked as a highway patrol officer since 1994, charged Harper with fleeing after confronting her at the scene of the crash. "Why didn't you stop?" Don is heard asking Harper in the dashcam video. Because I didn't feel it was safe, she responds, to which Don replies, well, this is where you ended up. According to Jalopnik, most precincts leave whether to chase a suspect or driver or not up to their officer.